morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, March 3rd, 2020, and the time is 9:02 a.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha von Imhoff, and I'm joined today by Senator Stedman, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, and Senator Hoffman. We also have Senator Coghill and Senator Giesel with us today. We have a quorum to do business. Our only item on today's agenda is Senate Bill 123, an act relating to the creation and regulation of electric reliability organizations, relating to participation of electric utilities in electric reliability organizations, relating to duties of electric reliability project organizations providing for integrated resource planning, requiring project approval for certain interconnected large energy facilities, and providing for an effective date. Senator Bishop's with us. Thank you. This is our first hearing on the bill. I'd like to invite Senator Coghill, Chair of the Senate Rail Belt Electric System Committee, to the table to introduce the bill, along with Rena Miller, staff to Senate President Giesel.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Senator Coghill, Senate Seat B. As you said, the chairman of the Rail Belt Energy Special Committee. We had one thing assigned to us, and that was Senate Bill 123. And staffing that committee is Rena Miller with me. So Rena has a PowerPoint, but what I thought I'd do, Madam Chair, is just give you kind of the high level why this is happening and what we intend to accomplish through this particular bill. Being born and raised on the rail belt, me and Anna being my hometown, I can remember a time when we were not connected to a power base either from Fairbanks or Anchorage. And as we grew, we became part of the Golden Valley Electric Association, and then we got interconnected with the south part of Alaska, and the six different utilities in the rail belt began to grow both population-wise and spreading out on how they served their customers. But they were all individual units given their own what is called a certificate of public convenience and need. As they began to interact, electrons began to flow across all these utilities. For years now, we've been talking about how to work together as different utilities in the different styles. Everything from how to manage the handoff from one to another, how to charge back, and all those issues have been what I would call issues for a number of years. So some years ago, and you'll see in the PowerPoint, we asked the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to help us figure out a way to help that work as a singular machine. The fact is, when you produce an electron, it's got to go somewhere and be used. You don't get to store those electrons, very seldom, maybe in batteries. But these six utilities have now grown to the place where they need to operate as a particular machine. So Senate Bill 123 does three primary things. I'll give you the skeletal approach, and that is to help this machine operate under what is called an ERO, Electric Reliability Organization. This gets all the utilities to work together, figuring out ways to create reliability. The end result is smooth operation and benefits to the ratepayers. The way they do that, Madam Chair, is they begin to put out reliability standards. Now, each organization already has some standards, but this will have the standard of a machine that is multiple of different utilities. They'll do planning process for reliability. They'll also do integrated resource planning, which will be a topic set right at the table of this reliability organization. So with that, they also then new generation will be the question. If you have a new generator coming online, how does it impact this whole reliability organization or the combination of all these utilities? So in this bill, you'll see the structure for the reliability organization, the integrated resource planning, and how do you do pre-approval of new generation coming in? How will it work? RCA, Regulatory Commission of Alaska, will be the backdrop to all of the work that they do, but there will be a lot of preliminary work. This bill says if you want to put a reliability organization together, which it looks like all six utilities at the point want to do, then you apply to the RCA to stand one up. If you don't, there is a structure in here for the RCA to require it. So this is a mandate. There are probably three things you need to know about the way this bill has come together. The utilities have already come up with what they call an MOU and a working group to work on some of these things. We get the benefit of that work, and we got some pretty strong agreement on the structure that this in Senate Bill 123. There are some extremities, some unusual circumstances that we have to work with, and so you'll see that we had 10 different hearings, but we also had four different committee substitutes. Most of that was based on either proving up the language that they could agree on, that RCA understood, that was good, what you call terms of art. Some of the other things were, how do you deal with Fort Wainwright, where they generate power, but they're a single utility, but they only supply one customer? How do you deal with the Bradley Lake issue that is not regulated but puts power into the system? So you'll see some issues in here that what I would call they're unusual to the structure, but they had to be accommodated for because we haven't grown to what I would consider a totally mature reliability organization yet. But this puts a structure in place for them to solve some of those issues. So that's the general issue. The goal is to not only have this machine working well in a reliability fashion, but to bring lower rates to those in the rail belt. That goes all the way from Homer, around Fairbanks, down to Delta. So I think once this bill gets in place, you have a collaboration that is going to be not only proved up, but given a good statutory structure to work with. With that, Madam Chair, I can turn it over to Rena, who has a PowerPoint to go through the bill with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Rena Miller, staff to Senator Giesel and on loan to the Rail Belt Special Committee for the purposes of this bill. I will try not to be redundant to Senator Coghill's remarks here. Working through the bill on page 2 of your PowerPoint, we set a little bit of context. You have documents in your packet that reflect this kind of chain of events. After decades of discussion as to how the rail belt might operate more efficiently and effectively to serve customers, in 2014, the legislature made a capital appropriation to the RCA with language directing them to evaluate that rail belt network and to return some findings and recommendations to the legislature. RCA Commissioner Anthony Scott, who will testify next, I believe, will talk a little bit more about those findings and recommendations that were delivered in 2015. They generally found that the utilities were acting very separately and addressing the needs of their customers that they are obligated to provide service for under their Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity within their service area, and that there was a lot of room for more joint work among the utilities that would serve the customers in the rail belt as a whole. One of the key recommendations, though, was that before mandating some form of cooperation, it was important to let the utilities try to come to some voluntary arrangements as to how they would move forward. So in the intervening years, up to 2019 or so, the utilities made significant progress working voluntarily. Sometimes, although there was that good progress, there has been no actual institutional reform. There's now this public process that the RCA started in 2019 to discuss statutory changes in order to cement that progress and to require that institutional reform. Bills were introduced in both bodies towards the end of the 2019 legislative session. Here in 2020, the RCA delivered its progress report to the legislature on those efforts. They have been quite clear that absent this bill, they will embark on a different process to require at least reliability standards for the rail belt network, as opposed to this bottoms-up process where the utilities, as experts in this field, are coming forward with the standards and the planning the alternative would be a top-down approach that, frankly, it sounds that no one really wants to undertake. So again, the overriding goal and the purpose is to cement the progress we've seen to date and to codify that and to capture the progress, to maintain that forward momentum, ultimately for benefit to ratepayers in reliability, security, and potentially avoiding future costs. So within SB 123, overall you're granting authority to the RCA to require and regulate electric reliability organizations, or EROs. The bill adds a new article to Section AS4205, the Public Utilities Regulatory Act. So within only one section of the bill, we're adding 10 new sections of statute. The bill defines the participation in an ERO, sets the rules for how an ERO gets certified by the RCA, lays out that basic framework for an ERO. There will be more specifics that are written through the regulations by the RCA. It defines the ERO's responsibilities. It ensures that the RCA has some backstop abilities and also oversight. And it does, as Senator Coghill said, require pre-approval for large new generation and transmission projects. So first we talk about participation in an ERO. If you're an interconnected network in which you have at least one utility that is regulated by the RCA, then the bill requires that you do have an ERO. There are some exceptions to that. If you are a system or a network in which all of those load-serving entities are exempt from RCA regulation as municipal entities or subdivisions of the state, the RCA cannot require you to have an ERO. The kind of key example of this, I believe, is the Southeast Power Agency that serves Petersburg, Ketchikan, and Wrangell. That is an instrumentality of the state, would not be required to have an ERO. Public utilities within a network are required to participate in the ERO. Everyone else in that network, whether or not a public utility, maybe an independent power producer, that kind of an entity, has to comply with the reliability standards that an ERO sets. The rail belt is the primary need that we're discussing, although the legislation was crafted to have general applicability. Because we don't know what the future of power in Alaska looks like, we have a few release valves. If there's a network and they petition the RCA, the RCA can waive the requirement to have an ERO if it's determined that an ERO is not actually going to add the benefit to that particular network that it's seen to add to the rail belt, for example. There's also the ability for a network that doesn't have those public utilities necessarily, the two connected ones, one of which is regulated, to request that they, even though they don't meet the requirements to have an ERO, that they can have an ERO. There's that option as well. And again, that's trying to look towards a future that we don't fully know as we sit here today.
Senator Hoffman
has a question.
Why, Madam Chair, why would we require the RCA to act if an utility that's not in there wants to get a waiver? So that would be an opt-out. Why wouldn't we include language in here where they would opt in? It would be their decision and not have to wait upon action by the RCA to say at some point they have to opt in.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, if I understand your question, you're saying if there's a network and there are utilities in that network, why would we say that the RCA will require them to have an ERO instead of allowing them to say, no, we want an ERO?
No.
Okay.
You said earlier that the ERO, if required by someone in the future, the RCA can exempt them from that process. Why wouldn't we reverse that and say if a utility may get some benefit by participating in the ERO, they should be able to take that upon themselves and make that decision and opt in instead of leaving that decision for future electric companies that are not in this system to have action by the ERO. It should be a local decision, not the RCA's decision. That's what I'm saying. The position should be reversed.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, thank you for explaining. The RCA felt that it's important, particularly when we do look at the rail belt example, where different utilities at different times, even though they're connected together, may have different positions as to whether or not the entity should be working together. The benefits come from applying things network-wide and ensuring everyone is participating and complying within that. And that's the reason that the bill requires the network to have an ERO, but it provides for the opt-out if all of those utilities within that network agree and demonstrate to the RCA that they can still maintain reliability standards and compliance without the RCA requiring an ERO for that network.
But this is a major public policy decision that should not be left to the RCA to make. It should be a public policy decision at whatever level that is being affected by this. So I wouldn't, even though I understand the benefits that RCA has, they should not be making this major public policy decision. We as the legislature should be discussing it and making it. And I would not be one that would give my decision-making on what's best public policy to the RCA for those that are not participating.
Senator Bishop.
Yes, Senator, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Coghill or Rena, to either one, who's in and who's out of this piece of legislation right now? Is the city of Tanana that owns the power company, are they, would they be inside this or outside that?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, within the rail belt network, if you are connected to that network, you will be subject to the standards for that network. Mm-hmm. Within the rail belt.
I understand that part, but sure. Your communities in, say, my part of the state that are not connected by the grid, mm-hmm. rural villages that have their own power, either individually or with a co-op like United Utilities, would they be a part of this or not be a part of this?
They would not be a part of it.
Thank you.
I think the expectation is these are interconnected utilities. And with regard to Senator Hoffman's question, Madam Chair, I think the first thing we'd have to do is ask the Regulatory Commission if they were issued a certificate of public convenience and need and in the interconnection, were they already regulated? And so exploring that is something that I think we should do to find out where our policy call would be and where we've turned that into law already as a policy call based on what we've required of RCA. So that's something that I'll explore, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have Senator Wilson followed by Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, so if my understanding is right, we have six utilities, possibly going down to five, and you have Anchorage Municipal, Light and Power, Chugach Electric, Golden Valley Electric, Homer Electric, Mountain Musica Electric Association, and the City of Seward. Is that correct?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, those are the six public utilities that are on the Rail Belt Network. There are other providers of power that feed into the network that would also be subject to the standards that are set by an ERO.
So,
Senator Wilson.
Can we get a list of those other additional ones that would be on that as well? Or I didn't see them all listed out here in the presentation yet.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, absolutely. We can talk about a few of them, and I believe Commissioner Scott with the RCA can maybe even provide a firm list. Doyon Utilities is a certified public utility that serves the bases in the Fairbanks North Pole area. They would be, they are part of this network. University of Alaska Fairbanks, if they feed generation from their plant into the network, they will need to comply with the reliability standards as well. Independent power producers such as Ceres Wind Farm at Fire Island, other there's the Delta Wind Farm. there is anyone that's independently producing power and attaching to the grid would be engaged in that. There are also wholesale power providers, essentially, for example, Bradley Lake, which is a state-owned, utility-operated hydro project that feeds significant power into the grid. Those are examples of who would be engaged, and we'll look for a complete list in the rail belt from the RCA.
Senator Wilson.
I guess, is there a power generation, is there a certain kilowatt hour minimum requirement if they feed back into the grid, or could you have some small farms and co-ops that may be sort of still in the grid, but they have more of a self, you know, those homeowners that may produce their own wind, solar, hydro power that goes back into the grid that they need to reduce on the rate. Do they have to also comply under the same standards, or is there a kilowatt production that they have to, minimum standards they have to meet?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, there is no minimum kilowatt production. It's a sense that anyone that's feeding in, anywhere there's an interconnection, uniform standards to govern security of the whole grid, reliability of the whole grid, cybersecurity of the whole grid are really important to have. I'm going to defer to Commissioner Scott, particularly on how that works with an individual homeowner that generates power and feeds back into the grid.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. That sort of touched on some of my concerns. But if a small company decides it wants to open up a solar plant somewhere in the valley or a wind farm, I just want to make sure that we're not inadvertently or advertently discouraging those small companies from coming into existence and providing renewable energy sources.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I'm pleased to say that we have had tremendous support from independent power producers and the Independent Power Producers Association. Right now, folks that are trying to bring new things on are looking to the future and finding it to be potentially very beneficial to have uniform grid-wide standards and rules and terms for them to make those interconnections and to put power in. They absolutely would have to comply with the reliability standards that an ERO sets. Absent an ERO setting those standards, if the RCA instead chooses to set those standards, they will also then need to comply with those. They're looking for, again, anyone that's interconnected to make sure that that helps the network as a whole.
Senator Wilikowski.
And that's a little bit of my concern. And if you have these huge dominant participants, the utilities, they have a huge cost structure. I would be a little bit concerned that they would maybe not be as supportive of smaller independent organizations coming online because I know most of them are nonprofits or co-ops, but it just makes it maybe less profitable for them.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, and I'm going to jump ahead a little bit in the presentation, but I think it's an important point to bring up now. The bill requires that the governing board of an ERO look a certain way, and it's designed to make sure that it's not simply an entity that is the six utilities. The bill specifically requires a board that's a balanced board or an independent board or a combination of the two. The utilities are concurrent to the bill. The six utilities have developed a framework to try and create an entity that would then apply to be this ERO. Within their agreement, there are six utility seats on their board. Another six are for the Alaska Energy Authority. Two, I believe, that the Independent Power Producers Association would nominate members to serve on. A consumer interest advocate group. And I think a public seat or two. In addition, both the bill and the utility's concurrent process has ex officio seats, number one from the RCA and number two from the Department of Law's RAPA section, the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section. So this board that governs the ERO is designed to not be utility driven or dominant, but to bring in that participation. Further, the ERO's process required in the bill is to be very inclusive of the various players and drivers within the rail belt. It's designed to be a very open and transparent process. And the RCA, in fact, in the bill, when they are reviewing the standards that are submitted by the ERO, and frankly, the Integrated Resource Plan, they're directed to consider the process that was used in developing these standards in this plan. The intent of that is for them to make sure that it, in fact, was an inclusive and broad, accommodating of different stakeholders product.
So thank you. How I see this is that there has been a lot of high costs due to unfettered capital projects being built up and down the rail belt. The large companies that were mentioned earlier have a specific constituency representing specific boundaries. This particular bill will create streamline operations up and down, I don't know, 500 miles, whatever it is, in the event that there is a wildfire and lines get burned, we can have backup transmission. If there is an earthquake and lines go down, we can have shared transmission, shared power. I don't think this is necessarily to try to keep the small alternative energy budding companies out of the market. I think it's actually going to do the opposite, in that it's going to try to finally control the costs of these specific members with their specific boundaries. And in regards to Senator Hoffman's, we are the legislature and we have the power of the purse. And if there is large capital, which very well could be if we need to upgrade some of these transmissions, that's where we, the legislature, can get involved. I think it's very important to have the RCA. They are an independent entity. You need to have that oversight. And to me, this is a long time coming, and actually have significant benefits for Alaska ratepayers, for reliability and backstop of transmission, so uninterrupted transmission, as well as finally we're going to have a little bit of oversight in terms of these large capital projects that are really increasing the cost. So anyway, thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe we're on slide 5 where we discuss forming an ERO. The bill is structured so that the RCA has 1 year to write regulations before the bill takes effect on July 1st, 2021. The concept is that once the bill takes effect and those regs are written, the RCA is to notify the utilities within a system that the RCA would require an ERO for that system. That kind of opens the door to applications, as we're open. An organization can apply then to the RCA to be the ERO. The RCA will look and ensure that this organization ensures those baseline requirements, which we'll talk about next. And if the RCA finds this organization in line, it can issue a certificate of public convenience and necessity, or a CPCN, to this entity to be the ERO. We have a backstop in case nobody applies to be the ERO. When the RCA sends out that notification that they're open to applications, it starts a clock. If no one has applied to be an ERO within 90 days, then the RCA must form an ERO for that network. If no one has been certified by the RCA within 270 days, the RCA must form an ERO. By statute, the timeline to issue that CPCN is 6 months, and so that's why that 270 days allows for up to 3 months for someone to apply and up to 6 months to certify that application. Moving on to page 6, we talk about the framework of an ERO. Again, there is a required structure for this entity in the bill. It is proscriptive, not prescriptive. They are required to be governed by an independent or a balanced board, as we discussed, or a combination. They are required to demonstrate that they have rules in place for open processes that are inclusive of the various stakeholders and interests, and that they have the ability to balance those interests with whatever internal operating rules this organization has developed. They also have to demonstrate that they have the ability to develop standards and to do this integrated resource planning, which are the two main jobs of an ERO. The applicant, of course, to be the ERO, will build on that structure, and the RCA will write regulations further defining this framework and what they need to see in order to deem an applicant successful and certificate them as the ERO. Okay. It's no problem. On page 7, we talk about
Madam Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Is there a set under the first bullet, under the framework of the ERO, independent or a balanced board or a combination thereof? Is there a structure that's there representative of the existing utilities, or is that going to be left undecided and be submitted by the ERO or the RCA if no one applies?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the bill on page 3 simply says that the governing board needs to have those ex officio members we discussed and has to be formed as an independent, a balanced stakeholder, or a combination board. That is as prescriptive as the bill is on this, the RCA is expected to write regulations defining even more what they're looking for in that. The legislation, the committee tried to not get too prescriptive, understanding that this is a law of general applicability that may apply in other areas of the state at some point in time where there may be different players, different interests, different stakeholders engaged.
So the answer, Madam Chair, is that it will depend upon any entity that submits their ERO plan, and that would be ultimately reviewed by the RCA, and if no one applies, then the RCA would set those.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that's absolutely correct. On to page 7, we discuss the responsibilities of the ERO. On a broad level, the RCA is basically delegating some work, some tasks to the ERO. The RCA maintains oversight of the ERO and of the things that it has told the ERO to do. It maintains authority, and it can, again, assign those tasks to the ERO. This, again, is a bottom-up approach. You're taking advantage of the expertise within the utilities and with other entities, what they know how to do best in developing these standards. The ERO will, again, set and enforce reliability standards, and it will develop an integrated resource plan. On slide 8, we'll talk a little more about the specific responsibilities. So the reliability standards relate to things like interconnections, reliable operation, cybersecurity, those things that keep the system safe and efficient and reliable. Standards will be filed as tariff provisions. What that does is sets in motion the existing RCA methods and timelines under AS4205 to process those items that are filed as tariff provisions, and it also brings in the RCA's existing public process rules related to that. So when the entity files a reliability standard, the RCA can simply approve it. The RCA can modify the standard, or the RCA can reject a standard, but only for form and filing. The there's an opportunity for, the ERO will also enforce reliability standards and has the ability to assess penalties for violations of standards. The RCA also has the ability, the backstop ability, to enforce standards and to assess penalties. There are provisions in the legislation for conflict resolution. Each of the utilities that's subject to standards is also subject to its existing tariff provisions and certificate of public convenience and necessity on file with the RCA to provide service to its service territory. In the unlikely event that there is some conflict between a reliability standard, an existing rule or tariff provision or function of a utility, there's a dispute resolution process in place. There's a special dispute resolution process in place for potential conflicts related to Doyon Utilities outside of Fairbanks and North Pole. Doyon Utilities serves those bases under Department of Defense contracts. The Department of Defense tells them often what their standards will be for operations and cybersecurity and whatnot. Doyon Utilities expressed a desire to meet whichever standard is highest, whether it's an ERO or the Department of Defense, but was concerned that in the event that there's actually a conflict between those, it is, again, under contract to Department of Defense and has to follow its standards. So a special provision then related to Department of Defense contracts makes sure that the Department of Defense standards always in instance of a conflict.
Maybe I should.
Sure.
Madam Chair, if I could just add something. This was one of the issues that, as it came before us, that there was a balance. We're standing up this new reliability organization and a new authority that it has RCA as part of its backstop. The question was, how much authority will we allow RCA to rewrite what the reliability organization brings forward, and how much authority will the reliability organization have to say, no, we know this from the bottom up? And so we put a review process in there that allows RCA to make some suggestions way before they have to go in and challenge those regs or their process. So this was probably one of the balancing things between standing up a new organization and letting RCA let RCA have the authority to challenge them, but not necessarily to get in the middle of it and rewrite it while they're doing it. And so that was one of the balances of power that was brought up as we came through this process.
We have Senator Hoffman followed by Senator Olson.
Thank you for those comments, Senator. Since this is a lot of additional authority to the RCA, I wonder if you can get the requirements and the membership of the current RCA board to me and the rest of the committee, because I think a lot that also has to be evaluated while we're transferring a lot of this authority to the RCA. I think that's something that the members should be well aware of.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I'm happy to provide that information. I can tell you who the commissioners are, but I can't give you all the requirements. So I think, too, it would be great if we could flag for Commissioner Scott to maybe discuss when he comes to testify that sense of additional authority to the RCA. I think he'd have some important feedback for you on that.
We do have Mr. Anthony Scott online, and he will be presenting after this. So, Senator Olson.
Actually, I didn't have a question.
No questions. Okay. All right, please continue.
Absolutely. So we've discussed the reliability standards. It's important to note that along with reliability standards, the bill does require the RCA to write regulations that will require the ERO to have a couple additional standards that are not reliability standards in its tariff. And those are going to be standards for non-discriminatory open access transmission and interconnection, and for transmission system cost recovery. The ERO is not seen as the entity that would be necessarily issuing an open access tariff. However, it can create those rules of the road so that anyone on the network that does so would have to do so in a manner consistent with what the ERO has put forward for the network.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Just a comment, and I would say, so this is where we're getting buy-in from the IPPs with this process here?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, this is a provision that actually was brought to us by one of the utilities, supported by the group of utilities working together, very heavily endorsed by Chris Rose with REAP, and also supported by the IPPs, yes.
Thank you.
Continuing on slide 8 related to responsibilities, the second core task assigned to the ERO is the responsibility for integrated resource planning for the network. Integrated resource planning is an exercise in which you basically figure out how to meet the needs of all those customers on the network at the greatest value, consistent with the public interest, using cost-effective means. You look at where demand is growing and shrinking. You look at where you have the ability to generate more power, where other generation may be ending life and coming offline. You look at how you're connecting all of these things, the power and the people that need it, and put in a plan going forward. This integrated resource plan is something that then is subject to RCA approval. When we talked about standards, we talked about the existing provisions in RCA statute as to how they would handle those as a tariff provision. There is no existing one related to the integrated resource planning, so we are a little more explicit in the bill on how that gets processed. It's filed as a petition. The RCA has a certain amount of time to either approve it or to open a docket for investigation, at which point they'll take testimony and feedback, work with the applicant on any modifications that the RCA thinks are necessary, and then ultimately approve it or have that backstop of modifying it. Yes. Any questions on the integrated resource planning? On slide 9, we talk about project pre-approval. This is not a task assigned to the ERO, but this is a significant change to within the bill. The legislation would require in a network served by an ERO that new generation and transmission is subject to RCA pre-approval. The thought is that if you're working together under this ERO and you are doing this integrated resource planning and you are addressing the projected needs and how you're going to meet those, that those are the projects that should be done and not necessarily new things that come up outside of that process unless the RCA grants pre-approval for those. This is a provision that's seen as something that protects both utilities and ratepayers. It is not pre-approval of costs. I think that's an important distinction. The project has yet to actually be done, and so those costs have yet to be prudently incurred or not. But it does set up a determination of in the public necessary for the public. There is a presumption within this that if you have a project that was included in an integrated resource plan, it is pre-approved. There's also a backstop, though, and if the RCA, using, quote, clear and convincing evidence, finds that something has changed since that planning process was undertaken, they can reject a project even if it was included in that plan. There are some exemptions for the requirement to have pre-approval of projects. Notably, those are for refurbishments and capitalized maintenance, maintenance overhauls, that type of thing, and also for hydropower projects that were licensed before October 2016 by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The RCA, there was some concern from utilities that we have kind of this no man's land in between the time that the bill takes effect and an integrated resource plan is accepted by the commission. And there is no presumption then of pre-approval for projects that maybe are undertaken within that time frame. And so the bill does require the RCA to write regulations addressing how they will handle those kinds of projects that are undertaken before an integrated resource plan is done and accepted. The project pre-approval requirement does have specific megawatt requirements to it. And so large generation plants with a combined capacity of 15,000 kilowatts or more with transmission lines. Also requiring project pre-approval or high voltage above ground transmission lines with capacity of 69 kilovolts or more that are longer than 10 miles, and high voltage submarine or underground cables that are longer than 3 miles. That made sure to wrap in any future Cook Inlet crossing, something that the RCA knows will likely need to be upgraded here at some point in time and wanted to be sure was included in project pre-approval requirements. It also includes, you also need pre-approval for energy storage devices or a combination of several at a single site with a capacity of 15,000 kilowatts, and also for reactive compensation devices, which I understand to be basically voltage control infrastructure that provide grid stability. And that, I believe, is SB 123. As we wrap up the conversation, I believe in your packet is included a letter of intent that the Rail Belt Special Committee chose to move forward with the legislation. This letter navigates some challenging terrain related to Bradley Lake and associated transmission from Bradley Lake. There's been ongoing litigation over several years related to the interpretation of the contracts governing Bradley Lake and the power that comes off of it. There is a longstanding exemption from RCA review of those contracts while the debt to fund the Bradley project initially is still in place. There are continuing differences in interpretation of what exactly those contracts mean. The letter of intent is designed to say that the legislature is choosing not to interject itself in that debate right now, and that the utilities need to go ahead and work that out, and where the legislature is choosing not to perhaps take sides in those matters at the moment. The full intent expressed in that letter of intent is that the standards, the participation in the resource planning process and pre-approval all apply to the Bradley Lake package as soon as possible, yet honoring that exemption from RCA review of the contracts until that debt is paid off. You have that letter in your packets.
Do we have any questions for the bill sponsors? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. On page 11, under the ERO, the second or the third bullet point, it says that there are six utilities, and then ex officio RCA, RAPA, and AEA, consumer groups, and IPPS. So are the six utilities part of the organization and all the rest of them contemplated by this piece of legislation ex officio, or is it just the RCA and RAPA?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I apologize, I neglected this slide. This was helpful, I think, to show kind of the relationships as we talk about the RCA, the ERO, and how it applies to the network. Specific to your question, this legislation does not require any particular entity to participate or not in that ERO governance board, except it requires ex officio RCA and RAPA membership on a board. This chart is reflective, as noted at the bottom, of the Rail Belt Utilities MOU. And again, the Rail Belt Utilities concurrent with this legislation process, parallel path, they're working to develop an entity that would eventually apply to be the ERO. The RCA has yet to write regulations, of course, as to what exactly a balanced stakeholder or independent board looks like. But meanwhile, the utilities have conceived a board that has seats for six utilities, AEA, consumer interest groups, independent power producers, and includes the ex officio RCA and RAPA members as required by the legislation.
Thanks for that clarification.
Any other questions? Senator Bishop.
Just a comment. Just a comment and a question to the to Senator Coghill or Raina for that matter. This to me has similarities with the North American Energy Reliability Council groups that's in the lower 48. Is that a fair analogy?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, the answer is yes. Given the unique circumstances of Alaska, we've had to fit it into Alaska's needs. And so this is, and to one other further point, this does give a new authority to a reliability organization, and it does give new authority also to RCA, but it tries to balance those, probably much like you would have in some of these other organizations down south. So yes, there was some pattern that we picked from, yes. And RCA is the one that actually picked those patterns, not us.
Right, thank you.
Okay, next up we have our invited testifier will be Anthony Scott, and I believe he is on the phone. He is the commissioner of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and I think Ms. Miller was going to stay at the table to help with slide, okay? So, Mr. Scott, when you're ready, could you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, and we have Ms. Miller here to work your slide deck if you need it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Anthony Scott. I am a commissioner at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I'm one of five. I'm very pleased to present to you today and to answer any questions that you may have about this bill. I want to start on slide two, if I might, briefly explaining what it is that the RCA does, why we exist. We engage in what's called economic regulation for larger utilities that are subject to our jurisdiction. What that means is we govern, we approve the terms of service that utilities engage in with their customers. In a competitive economy, that's not done, of course. In a competitive economy, we have free entry, free exit, and the results of competitive markets are economically efficient. And for certain kinds of industries, in particular electric utilities, those industries are natural monopolies, and they are not, by virtue of their very large capital intensiveness and because of the fact that it's just most efficient, for example, to have a single set of wires distributing power to end-use customers. They are natural monopolies, and they're not subject to effective competition. And so what we do is we all certificate individual utilities to provide reliable, safe, affordable power to all of the consumers in their area. And our statutes and powers are designed to ensure that the outcome of the terms of service reasonably replicate what would happen in a fully competitive market. The stakes of what we do are large. In 2018, which is the last year we have full data for, Rail Belt consumers spent about $880 million on their electricity bills. Roughly speaking, half of that was for the capital costs of the means of providing service. So the transmission lines, the distribution lines, the generators, the batteries, such as they exist. Once you build those, they have a very long lifetime, roughly speaking 30, 35, sometimes as much as 50 years for certain transmission lines. And you have to pay that each and every year, whether or not you use it very much at all. So those fixed capital costs of the system are material. I spend some time explaining that because if we can move to slide two, please, three, please. The issue of reliability, which sounds sort of esoteric and obscure and don't we have pretty much reliable service anyway, goes directly to the issue of costs that consumers pay. Senator Coghill earlier explained that an interconnected system like we have in the rail belt is a singular machine. Once you interconnect multiple utilities, demand and supply have to meet exactly each and every second, and in fact, each and every sub-piece of a second. If they don't, the system can have trouble. In fact, the system can go down. And so it's very important to have adequate generating and transmission capacity to meet demand exactly when it's needed. So you may want to make sure that you have enough, and you want to make sure that it's synchronized properly, and you want to make sure that all of the actors on the system are coordinated properly with each other. And to do that, of course, requires an enormous amount of capital investment, and again, once that investment is made, it needs to be paid off over the next 30 years, whether or not it's needed. So I'll speak to other provisions in the bill later that link economic outcomes, development, what ratepayers actually pay, to these reliability standards that are contemplated as being developed and enforced under the bill. So in slide three, this is covering ground that's already been addressed a little bit. In 2014, the legislature appropriated money and directed the commission to provide recommendations on whether creating an independent system operator or similar structure for utilities in the rail belt is the best option for efficient and effective electrical transmission. The commission held hearings, at multiple hearings over the course of that next year, and ultimately found in findings and recommendations that were summarized to the legislature, but that the full record occupied thousands of pages, that indeed there was room for improvement in the rail belt. We did not live in the most efficient set of circumstances, and that we indeed could do better through institutional innovation. So we provided findings and recommendations to the legislature in 2015. We've updated those most recently this year. After 5 years now and many, many more thousands of pages of hearing transcript, testimony, many meetings, and SB 123 is an outgrowth of that process. The commission has twice in public meetings now unanimously voted to support SB 123, and we think it'll provide, if it is enacted, it would provide material consumer benefits. I want to go back on slide four, please, to our findings. And this again addresses sort of the issue of why the Regulatory Commission exists. Again, we found that there were inefficiencies associated with having six separate utilities all acting independently. We found insufficient coordination across utilities that resulted in inconsistent, inadequate, and currently unenforceable electric reliability standards. The commission, while we now have a single set of reliability standards, those are voluntary. There is no robust mechanism of enforcement, and indeed, when it is inconvenient from time to time, individual utilities do not abide by the voluntary standards that exist right now. We found that there was insufficient integration between utilities and their planning and construction of new generation and transmission assets. And so that while each of the utilities for their own service territory were doing a good job reliably meeting the needs of their own customers, that there were opportunities for capital cost savings that probably were not being captured. We found that the transmission infrastructure, which benefits everyone, was suffering from market failures. We did not have a good business model for a single entity to construct needed transmission that would provide reliability or economic value, and then have a way of charging utilities outside of its service territory for the benefits associated with that piece of transmission infrastructure. So we didn't have a good business model to ensure cost recovery. And lastly, we found that the level of coordination and integration across the utilities meant that the use of existing facilities could probably be made more efficient. That is, it stands to reason that the most efficient generators on the system should run as maximally as possible regardless of ownership. So we did not have adequate institutions and tools to ensure that that, in fact, happens. There's a certain amount of efficiency, which indeed is captured every hour of every day, but that there was opportunity for improvement. So on slide five, we made recommendations that we needed a consistent and enforceable set of operating and reliability standards. We needed to solve the business model problem of so that new transmission infrastructure, if it were needed, if it could provide economic value, could in fact get built appropriately. We found that project pre-approval was an authority that should probably be expressly given to us, and not basically a traffic cop role, so that we could ensure that before any individual utility came forth and asked to, and built something new, that we were capturing all of the efficiencies across utilities, that is, making sure that there were economic deals in place, so that that capital investment could provide the most benefits for the greatest number and was indeed appropriately sized. And last, we found that we should allow time for voluntary efforts between the utilities to produce fruit, to solve the problems that we, or issues that we had identified. And initially, the commission had set deadlines of about a year and a half. We're more than 5 years down the road. Well, we're fully 5 years down the road now. And on slide six, I'm happy to report that we've had some progress. Voluntary efforts have indeed laid the groundwork for institutional reform. The conversations that the commission has helped drive between the utilities have educated all of us, both the utilities and the commission and the broader public, of ways of solving the various inefficiencies that currently exist. And indeed, in late 2018, the Rail Belt utilities reached consensus to form an organization that would include non-utility stakeholders to address reliability and integrated resource planning. So we've made progress, but it's also the case that we don't currently have a thing. We don't have institutional reform. And one of the things that we have found is that sort of sealing the deal, getting final institutions together, agreed to, is difficult. Although we have an MOU between the utilities to form an electric reliability organization, I'd like to say if MOUs could be taken to the bank, we'd have a natural gas pipeline by now. So we've made progress, but I think I think we're sort of ready now to close the deal. And to do that, I think all of the utilities in the Rail Belt and the commission and the public as a whole need your help. Slide seven captures what that help would look like. SB 123 is substantially modeled on federal legislation. There was a question earlier about whether this looks like what they have in the rest of North America. In terms of the relationship between the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the NERC, or the North American Electric Reliability Council. And the answer is that this bill was initially, it's not a bill, we put out language for public comment which was very substantially modeled on that federal legislation. And through feedback from utilities and the legislative drafting process and many public hearings, that initial set of concepts, I think, has been honed to reflect a piece of general legislation that fits both the needs of the rail belt and addresses the particular circumstances of Alaska in general. So the bill substantively addresses consistent enforceable reliability standards, as Ms. Miller earlier alluded to. It requires integrated resource planning to identify optimal new infrastructure needs. Integrated resource planning in this context would be planning that is integrated across utilities and planning that also integrates across all potential resources. To some degree, generation and transmission assets can substitute for one another. Battery technology can provide for reliability sometimes where otherwise generation might have been required. Energy conservation, in fact, can reduce the need for new construction, and new conservation programs are things that should be considered and potentially brought onto the system. So then what it does is it requires that large projects, large infrastructure projects, receive pre-approval so that, again, that's just a backstop, so that we can ensure that large capital expenditures indeed benefit most consumers most efficiently. And then lastly, in terms of the business model for transmission, which I addressed earlier, while the commission's original recommendation was to form a single transmission-owning company, a Transco, and that would have solved the business model problem. An alternative pathway has been identified where, through appropriate cost-sharing mechanisms that would be established in standards that would be developed in the future, and consistent interconnection agreements, we could this bill would enable new transmission, if it were identified as being needed, to be built and its costs captured on a system-wide basis. And the details of what that looks like have yet to be hashed out and will, I'm sure, be the subject of many, many, many long hearings and lots of public input. On slide 8, one of the key things that this legislation does is it makes an ERO an electric utility which is subject to the commission's jurisdiction. The original MOU amongst the utilities contemplated that the RCA would indeed serve as a backstop to the ERO. But the MOU did not recognize that we currently could not regulate an ERO because an ERO is not subject to our statute. It's not, wouldn't qualify as a public utility. On slide 9, the commission would not be delegating its authority to the ERO for reliability and planning. Instead, what it would do is this, it would assign most of the work to the ERO. And in general, it would follow the ERO's lead in terms of reliability standards. But we would serve as a backstop, so we could impose a remedy in the event of inaction or insufficient progress or disputes among parties or insufficient attention to the public interest. And we certainly hope and expect that given the structure of the bill, In general, the commission would have very little to do. Applications for new standards and applications for new projects would come to the commission fully vetted, and we would approve them very rapidly within normal 45-day process, which would provide for public notice, and that would be that. The bill meshes with the Utility Act, and so all of our general machinery for ensuring non-discrimination and public notice, timelines for action requirements, timeline for action, all of that is sort of meshed in and would proceed apace. So that's captured on slide 10. And with that, I apologize for being a little bit scattered. I'd be happy to answer questions.
So slide 10, yes, we finished your slide deck. Is there any questions for Mr. Anthony Scott? Mr. Scott, you were very thorough, and thank you for going through your slide deck. We appreciate you laying out the incentives and how the RCA and the ERO will interact with one another. The
Madam
next.
Chair, thank you very much. If I might, there are a couple of questions that were asked earlier that I would like to briefly address, if I could.
Yes, please go ahead.
One of them that I jotted down concerned the applicability of this legislation to other potential systems statewide. And at this time, no other area in the state would be subject to, would be required to have an electric reliability organization. We spent a fair amount of time to try to make sure that the current exemptions from regulation that exist throughout most of the state would be honored. And those exemptions exist and were established by the legislature generally for very good reasons. Regulation is not cheap, and so for small rural systems, we did not want to create disincentives for rural systems to interconnect if that made sense for them to do so. Those small rural systems currently, for the most part, are not economically regulated, and so they would not be subject to this bill. However, we also wanted to create permissively, if they wanted to form an ERO, that we could provide that structure and backstop for them. Again, in the rail belt, for example, this bill exists in part because we lack the current statutory authority to fulfill the part of the vision that the MOU among the six rail belt utilities have come to. So, again, right now, no other area of the state would be forced to form an ERO. In general, if we had small systems with interconnected utilities, say one of which was not exempt, and so it would be potentially subject to the requirement to have an ERO, in general, what we would expect is that the commission would waive the requirement unless there was reason to think that there were benefits to consumers that would be captured. An earlier comment that was made, I wholeheartedly agree with, which is that most of our smaller utility systems statewide require a fair amount of capital subsidy, which comes often, historically has come from the legislature to ensure service. And in general, I would think it would be very unlikely that the benefits of forming an electric reliability organization would be sufficient. But in any case, the legislature would have an opportunity to address those circumstances as they arise through the power of the first. But again, the thought at least had been to allow the opportunity, if systems grow and interconnect, to capture efficiencies when systems were large enough and the parties were subject to economic regulation. Senator Wilikowski, I believe, asked a question about disincentives for independent power producers. I would like to reinforce Ms. Miller's comments that the bill would actually provide a normalized pathway and would facilitate development of independent power to the extent that that made economic sense. Solving the problem of uniform interconnection tariffs and the problem of a lack of a business model for new transmission is a material one for independent power producers, especially for renewable power producers, because the appropriate place to place the generation is not necessarily always where the load is that might need that generation. So I think this will help that. And then finally, I wanted to briefly address Senator Wilson's question, I believe it was Senator Wilson's, about whether this would affect individual homeowners who, for example, had rooftop solar installations. And the answer is no. The ERO would set standards for the sort of market participants on the system, including, I mean, it's a wide range of players who are, say, generators or transmitters of power. But in general, consumers with net metering arrangements, for example, they are subject to their own utilities tariffs. To interconnect, for example, a rooftop solar system, or to interconnect a small wind, you know, home-based wind system, and potentially feed power into the grid, that homeowner is required to meet certain tariff standards. Those tariff standards are the province of that individual utility. But at the end of the day, the overall system standards would flow downhill. So there'd be nothing in terms of participation that would be required, but just as exists today, the individual homeowner would be subject to those particular tariff standards around the quality of power and the kind of equipment that they're required to have and that sort of thing. So I believe that's all of the questions that I jotted down. The last comment that I'd like to make is that while this looks like it's only a rail belt bill, it actually has much broader implications for the state as a whole. I mentioned before that the wringing out efficiencies in terms of the capital cost of our system is extremely important for rail belt consumers. It's about half of their annual budget of electricity, so we could call it $500 million, roughly speaking, annually. That $500 million, to the extent it is inefficient, raises the rates of consumers in both Fairbanks and Anchorage. By doing that, it raises the floor for PCE payments. And what that means is as rail belt electricity rates rise, PCE payments to rural Alaska fall. And so creating more efficiency in the rail belt is good for consumers, not just in the rail belt, but also for any consumer who is receiving PCE payments. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scott, and thank you for that final point. That's actually very sobering in many aspects. Are there any questions for Mr. Scott? I thought I did a good job asking or answering the questions that committee members had brought up. So thank you, Mr. Scott, for taking the time. We really appreciate it. We do have other invited testimony, as well as we would like to open up public testimony as well. So we actually have, for the next invited testimony, we have representatives from the Railboat Utilities Organization Development Team, Julie Estee, Director of External Affairs, Matanuska Electric Association. Is that correct? Julie, are you on the line?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm here.
Okay. And do you have a PowerPoint presentation for us?
That was sent in yesterday.
Okay. It is up there. Okay.
We
have Rena Miller here, and she can help go through the slides. So whenever you're ready, state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Estee. I'm with Matanuska Electric Association, and I'm also here representing the Organizational Development Team, which is a group of colleagues from each of the six utilities that are working to develop an ERO that we're calling the Railbelt Reliability Council, or the RRC. I want to thank the committee for dedicating some pretty substantial time today during a very busy session, and I will do my best to make effective use of that time and not retread ground that it was already well covered by Ms. Miller, Senator Coghill, and Commissioner Scott. We, as the organizational development team, as Ms. Miller represented, are in strong agreement among each other. And with this legislation, we view Senate Bill 123 as enabling legislation for the work that we're doing. And I do have a few of my counterparts on the phone if there are additional questions. Slide two just represents an outline of what I'll be covering today, so we can breeze through that and move right to slide three. Just a basic overview of the electric system. It goes from Homer up to Fairbanks and then over to Delta in the north and Glacier View in the south. It's about 800 megawatt load, roughly, and it's not really a robust grid. It's pretty generous, actually, to even call it a grid. It is the largest interconnected system in the state, but we don't have the robust grid that the lower 48 has. It's more of a series of interconnected grids, and so that prevents hurdles for implementing some structures and solutions that are common in the lower 48. That being said, there is a lot that we can be doing to operate more closely as an interconnected system. One other thing that I'll point out is that it has a significant amount of infrastructure with very few members that cover those costs. MEA thinks about that a lot. We have just around 53,000 members and 4,300 miles of line to cover those. So when we do make a decision to make an investment in our system, it is done with the utmost respect for those members. Most of us at MEA are also members and pay the same electricity bills, and also just an understanding of the costs and the benefits with that. One question that I get a lot when I talk about the efforts that the Railbelt utilities have been working on is, hey, why is there not just one utility? And I think that's a fair question that we need to continue to ask. I will say, is because we're all public power, there's lots of hurdles, both legal and financial, about that. Whether those benefits outweigh the costs is interesting. I think we'll have a great pilot project from the MLMP sale to Chugach Electric if the RCA approves that. Some folks say, hey, if it were profitable or made sense, it would have been done already. And I think that's a discussion that we need to keep having, but it's a discussion for a future day. In the meantime, what we do want to focus on is how we can work more closely with what we have. For MEA, for instance, we have 6%, when you look at the cost of our members' bills, 6% of that goes to administration. 40%, on the other hand, almost, goes to the cost of gas. And so to make a real impact to our members' bills, what we can focus on now and what we have some control over is burning less fuel. And no matter what side of the political spectrum you sit on, I think we can all agree that burning less fuel is good, whether that's from a conservation standpoint, or a cost-saving perspective, energy security, that is the thing that we are focused on most. And again, since I am representing MEA, I work for MEA, but representing the organizational development team, I'll try to make it clear when I'm speaking for either. So moving to slide four, what problems are we trying to solve? And I think Ms. Miller and Commissioner Scott really addressed the first one very well. There was the June 2015 letter from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to the legislature, basically saying benefits can be achieved with more coordination. So again, they allowed the utilities to first do it voluntarily and then sent a follow-up letter earlier this winter that applauded the current accomplishments but indicated, as Commissioner Scott said, the need for some help to get things over the finish line with the voluntary efforts. In addition to trying to meet those requirements, although, you know, anytime the RCA sends a letter, we pay attention. There are other options or other obstacles and new challenges that we face as a grid that we are trying to solve through this. First, the needs of our system are changing. The utility system is changing across the world, across the country, and Alaska is no different. For instance, cybersecurity threats is a game changer. And we have an integrated system. We have significant assets on that system, notwithstanding, you know, Department of Defense assets, critical oil producing assets. And so we are ever vigilant about the cybersecurity threats and our need to meet them and to be ahead of them every day. So that is something that we need to tackle as an integrated system. The reliability expectations are higher than ever, especially as we think about attracting new industry to the state that's dependent on that power. So those expectations are even higher than ever. And the integration of new technologies. We've talked a little bit about the integration of renewables, storage. There's, you know, carbon reduction goals. Many of the utilities on the rail belt have those. We're more adept and effective at meeting those when we can work together as a more integrated whole. We're also looking ahead at infrastructure development and costs, and that's really where a lot of the big benefit of this comes from, is when there's large projects to consider. Right now, we are very good at looking at projects within our service territory and making smart economic reliability go, no-go decisions. What we can do better at is making those decisions as a group, and so looking at those infrastructure development big projects, how they might benefit, and how you share those costs. Where does the benefit hit, and how can the different memberships and the different ratepayers along the rail belt be made whole, and so that the cost causer is cost payer, which is a big tenet of rate making for us. It's also important for us to retain some ability to address specific local issues, maintain some local control for our co-ops while being able to think and act regionally, and we believe that the current solution achieves this. And really, I think a big benefit of this new structure is to be able to have critical conversations and build trust. And that's not just among the utilities, although that's critical, but we are also talking about opening those discussions up to independent power producers, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the Alaska Energy Authority, which is the state energy office. All of those voices are critical in this, and so this provides a structure for us to be able to have important conversations, make decisions, build trust, and be able to act when critical needs demand it of us. So moving on to slide five, the progress we have made is some consistent reliability standards in the rail belt. In 2014, the Intertie Management Committee, which is the group of utilities that use the Intertie, adopted open access rules. Those consistent set of reliability standards were also filed along with the Alaska Energy Authority in April 2018. And as Commissioner Scott mentioned, currently they are voluntary because we have no mechanism to really significantly enforce those, which is one of the requests that we have here. And when you think about reliability, I know when I talk about reliability with different forums, eyes tend to glaze over, but basically it's just redundancy. How much redundancy do you want to have on the system? And the answer is, for everybody, we want lots of redundancy, of course. I mean, redundancy is good, but redundancy is also expensive. And so, again, there's that cost-benefit analysis of when those costs of redundancy meet the how beneficial that next increment of reliability can get. On the rail belt, we have a very thin threshold that's managed very tightly, and I think that's kind of the unsung work of the utilities is the day-to-day operational work of the folks in the dispatch centers and the operation department. We have been running this pretty fragile system pretty well with great reliability, but again, we can manage, or we acknowledge that we can do better. So things that are part of reliability standards are things like how much spinning reserves do you have? So how much do you need to have online for an event that might impact a generator? How much do you put on reserves that's not mothballed but ready to produce power in case a power plant has an issue or needs to go under maintenance? So those are the kinds of things that we are talking about. And just to answer a previous question, there are the current standards that are in effect apply for generation over 10 megawatts. So, again, not touching some of those very small generators that were brought up earlier in the conversation. Again, those could be adjusted with new reliability standards with this RRC. But for those smaller ones, it's actually up to each utility specifically to help manage those interconnections and make sure that they are meet the reliability standards. So it kind of goes in through the utility to meet those standards. So again, there's no mechanism of real enforcement, and so those voluntary standards are in place until there is a mechanism for accountability. I'm going to page 6. This is one, man, we could talk about for the entire session on cybersecurity. We do have to keep a lot of our conversations with this fairly confidential, so we don't talk a lot about it, but we're constantly under attack. We're keeping both the system sacred, as well as our member information sacred. And so it's definitely making sure that the vulnerabilities are tamped down. The U.S. government has given us substantial resources, so we've got some of the top cybersecurity teams from Homeland Security, FBI, and others do audits. We're working very closely with them on how we can harden our system and keep it operating at tip-top operational levels, and we also have now those resources to rely on if we have questions. And again, it's not just the utilities, but also as we interconnect, we want to make sure those vulnerabilities continue to stay low. And so we're working very hard together with a working group, because the more that we can understand what's happening at each utility, the more we can, one, create solutions for the future as an integrated whole, but also learn from each other. Going on to page 7, the power pool development. This is something that's also mentioned in the MOU that has been signed that I'll talk about a little bit later. But it's facilitating something towards economic dispatch, yes, and which basically means that the next increment of load as it comes onto the system is met by the next most efficient generator, no matter where it is. So if MEA has a high increase in load, or as the drag line comes on up in Golden Valley, that is met by the next increment of load. So there was a study done that estimated the value of what that economic dispatch could bring to the system, and it was found that the majority of the value would be done and found working with Chugach Electric, Municipal Light and Power, and MEA right here in the South Central region. So we started conversations to create a contractual structure to move forward with that. Now, we're already doing what we call a loose pool, which is if I have extra generation or if I need generation, we can call over to MLMP, Chugach, Golden Valley, hey, do you all have some? How much would it cost? Or we have some, here's how much it would cost, and then they can make the economic decision. We're already spending a lot of time and effort with these economic transactions. A lot of those economic transactions, speaking for MEA, have already lowered the cost for MEA members. In fact, we saw a rate decrease this quarter because of those economic transactions. And it's estimated that we're seeing about 80% of the value now, but there's still 20% out there, and that needs to be achieved as much as we can. So a tight pool makes that loose pool, which is basically voluntary, informal conversations, it makes it contractual, and it makes it automatic. And so that is that next level of we are in a contractual agreement to make the most economic decision happen at any given time. So considerable effort was given to that. Three utilities, Golden in the South Central area, Golden Valley and Homer, were also invited to the conversations. We had solved a lot of the technical issues, tried to get a sense of the value of that, and then also creating settlement, which is basically at the end of the day, how is everybody made whole for all of this, these transactions? It was put on hold as MLMP and Chugach finish their hopeful potential sale in the future, and we look forward to taking that back up again. And then the MOU also includes a provision that we will do a full system analysis where everybody can come to the table, agree with the estimates, agree with the assumptions, and move forward with that. So, again, that there was substantial amount of work done. We're very close, but, again, put on hold until there's clarity between the MLMP Chugach sale. So moving on to slide 8, we look at the work that's been done to create an ERO, or the Rail Belt Reliability Council. And that's been happening really over the last 2-3 years. Initially, ARCTEC, which is a consortium of rail belt utilities, brought on an expert from the lower 48 named GDS to look at what something like this could look like. So they spent some time talking to all the different stakeholders and came up with a recommendation. ARCTEC then asked a member from each of the utilities, and ARCTEC has 4 utilities in it, and we expanded that to include all 6, to form this organizational development team and try to stand up and make this RRC happen. So there was about a year-long process where the utilities met and formulated an MOU for how we thought this could work. We then brought it out to the rest of the stakeholders, and they said, in no uncertain terms, this is a nice thought, but you need to include our voices in this. And so we spent the next year meeting with a variety of stakeholders, including the RCA, Alaska Energy Authority, Renewable Energy Alaska Project, several IPPs, including SERI. So they were all involved in this conversation. The MOU was renegotiated, and now it was signed on December 18th by all 6 utilities, which most of you guys sitting around the table have been at this a while and know what a groundbreaking event that was. That took a lot of not just negotiation, but we started acting differently. We started coming to the table, showing all of our cards, talking about our vulnerabilities, and really understanding how we could work together to solve the problems. And that was really what made that happen. The MOU was then signed and filed with the RCA on December 20th, and that started a clock of next steps. And we'll talk a little bit about those as well. We also started looking at it and saying, okay, this is what we're looking for, RCA. We want you to have the authority over this. And I think that's when the RCA started really understanding if this is what's going to be asked of us, then we need to make the statutory authority more clear. And that was where Senate Bill 123 arose. So our goal is to stand up a Rail Belt Reliability Council and apply to be the ERO once this is established. And if you go to slide 9, we talk a little bit about what the Rail Belt Reliability Council will do. Again, this closely mirrors the language in Senate Bill 123 and the companion bill, House Bill 151.
So, Ms. Esty, so real quickly, I'm just watching the time. We have 20 minutes left. You still have several slides in your presentation, and we have people waiting to testify. So I just wanted to mark the time, and if you could not necessarily rush, but at the same time be efficient with the remaining slides, please.
I'm happy to do that, Madam Chair. So again, slide 9 indicates what it will do. It's the reliability standards. It's the open access rules, procedures, and protocols with how you interconnect and use the system. It's also the integrated resource planning, which is a key component, and a cost-benefit analysis of the economic dispatch. Moving to slide 10, it talks a little bit about the governance structure that we are moving forward with for this MOU. Again, it matches that of Senate Bill 121. It has utilities, Alaska Energy Authority, independent power producers, a consumer advocacy group, two non-affiliated members, and then RCA and RAFA with ex officio seats. We have been moving towards this. There's also been a lot of questions for me about, well, what if there's less than six utilities if the sale of MLMP and to Chugach goes through, for instance. So just to preempt that question, the plan is currently, as it's anticipated, at least into the implementation committee, is to keep that seat and fill it with another utility representative, whether it be somebody else on the system like Doyon or compatible utility like NSTAR, or even somebody that's not connected but maybe in the future like Copper Valley. So we just want to make sure, and I'll highlight this now, that the IPP voice and other voices is heard. And there's definitely a lot of support for making those projects work on the rail belt. Moving to slide 11, why is the Rail Belt Reliability Council important? And I think lots of people could answer this question differently. For the utilities, it's a significant leap of faith for us, and there's a lot of commitments around that. It's groundbreaking for us. Right now, we have complete control over our small service territories, and this is broadening that to a regulatory compact with the state, a commitment that we're bound by the decisions of the RRC, which is a large leap for us, a commitment to support the statutory language, which we're doing right now to enable the RRC or another ERO, and a commitment to be inclusive of a variety of perspectives, which is also, you know, we have billions in assets, we answer to members. There has been reluctance to open up decision-making authority to a broad range of voices, but we do think that when the tent gets bigger, the solutions, it takes a little bit longer, as we're finding, but they're always improved. And so that we're looking forward to this allowing us to think regionally. As far as going to slide 12, next steps, we're laid out in the MOU are the steps to set up what we call the implementation committee. We are working towards that. The next step in the process is to hear who our two independent power producers are. We received 17 applications for the various seats that are available. And with all the different steps that need to happen, we're looking forward to that happening by mid-May. So going to final page 13, we support the passage of Senate Bill 123 as enabling legislation. And as Commissioner Scott mentioned, this is where we need your help to make this all happen. It makes the authority of the RCA clear. This is important work with lots of effort going into it, and we want to make sure that the RCA has the jurisdiction to make it stick. It's a mechanism for enforcement of critical reliability standards. It allows for the ERO to conduct integrated resource planning with RCA blessing, which will allow us to plan together as a group. It provides pre-approval, another big leap for the utilities, which is a change in a current authority, but we believe it's important to enable the integrated resource plan and reliability standards. And then it also provides a timeline. The utilities are very, very good with deadlines, and without them, there's a lot of other work that keeps us sometimes distracted or unfocused. And so it's great to have the backstop of the RCA to keep us not necessarily motivated, but to keep us focused and fixed on a timeline. So in short, this is a historic time. There is unprecedented alignment around the solution, not only from the utilities, but also with independent power producers and other stakeholders, with the RCA, with two very diverse legislative energy committees, and we hope that this committee will also support the passage of Senate Bill 123. And my goal is, you know, this is a very delicate house of cards. We're carrying through the process and across the finish line. My hope is that it stays focused and focused on the solutions. And let's not let this opportunity go to waste. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Esty, for your testimony, and thank you for going through your PowerPoint. Do we have any questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none at this point, I would like to open to, thank you, Ms. Esty, really appreciate that. I would like to open to public testimony on SB 23. Okay, we have a couple folks online. I encourage testimony will be limited to 3 minutes. And if you would like to encourage everyone to submit written testimony to finance.committee@aklege, that's aklege.gov. So the first person I see online at this point is we have Mr. Jeff Warner from Municipal Light and Power. I have you for questions, but would you like to testify for 3 minutes?
Yeah, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I don't have any testimony. I will just make a brief statement if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Senate 123, and I'm with Municipal Light and Power, if I didn't say that. Senate Bill 123 will significantly improve the ability of the rail belt as a whole to operate in an efficient and effective manner. The bill will provide specific reliability and security, including physical security, that are necessary in today's world. This concludes my comments for now.
Thank you, Mr. Warner. Is there any questions for MLNP? Thank you. The next person I have is Mr. Chris Rose, Renewable Energy Alaska Project.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was on the line to answer any questions, but as long as I am online, I'd say I'm the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project and support SB 123 and have submitted a written testimony to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. We appreciate that. Okay. The next person we have is Mr. Brian Hickey, Chief Operating Officer, Chugach Electric Association in Big Sky, Montana. Is that correct?
I'm in Big Sky, Montana, but I'm actually the Chief Operating Officer of Chugach Electric Association in Anchorage, Alaska.
Okay.
I've been working in the rail belt for about, through the chair, I've been working in the rail belt for about 40 years, and I wanted to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules to work on this matter. At Chugach, we believe that establishing an electric reliability organization will benefit the consumers both from a reliability perspective as well as a more cost-effective allocation of capital in the construction of facilities. And so I'll keep my comments brief, but we do support the current version of Senate Bill 123. And once again, thank you for taking this up. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Brian. Is there any questions for Chugach Electric? I don't see any, so enjoy Montana at this time. Is there anybody in the room? Is there anyone else online that wishes to testify? Seeing and hearing none, public testimony is closed. We are going to cover the fiscal note another time, not today. If we're going to set this bill aside. If any committee members have any comments or amendments, please let my office know. Senator Wilson.
Yeah. I know that we're going to cover the note another time, but I just have a question, and maybe that can be covered and hopefully have that ready to present for the note on just who will fund sort of the positions there if there's not a submission for the ERO. I see the note's a zero note, so there has to be some cost, and I don't see that really addressed within the note of this bill.
I think that you are correct in the fiscal note, but I do believe that there's a portion in the bill that discusses, I can see here, it's on here. Hold on. There is a section, oh, I saw it. We will discuss it at another time, and there is a cost that's discussed in the note, yes, or in the bill. But that does conclude today's meeting. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. We will have an update on our fiscal situation from Legislative Finance Division, and we will be taking public testimony on the supplemental budget. So we are adjourned.